number 85926, Castillo versus Western Range Association. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Counsel, come on up. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, please.
Okay. So as you heard a few minutes ago, when the clock ticks down to 4 minutes, you'll get the yellow light and a tone, but the clock keeps running down to zero.
Understood.
Okay, go ahead.
Please the court. My name is Christine Weber. I'm counsel for plaintiff Abel Cantaro Castillo. This case concerns the minimum wage amendment, a provision that Nevada voters added to the Constitution to expand protection for workers and ensure they're paid for each hour worked at minimum wage. Specifically, the question that's been certified to this court is how the Nevada Minimum Wage Amendment defines work, specifically in the context of workers whose jobs include on-call responsibilities, where their activities are restricted and they must remain alert to respond to the employer's needs. The dispute is over whether such time constitutes hours worked and thus minimum wage must be paid. While the court has not previously addressed the definition of work in the context of such on-call time, it has given clear direction on how to identify the answer. In Doe Dancer 1, this court held that in interpreting the Nevada Minimum Wage Amendment, as with other constitutional provisions, it will follow the plain language if the meaning is clear, and if not, will look to the purpose of the amendment or to parallel federal or state statutes. Here, the Minimum Wage Amendment does not include a definition for work. It states only that wages must be paid at the stated minimum wage for each hour worked. Turning to the purposes of the Minimum Wage Amendment, while not providing a specific definition, they do provide an important context. This court in Gonzalez versus State noted that in addition to raising the minimum wage, the amendment was designed to broaden the class of workers with access to the minimum wage. And in Thomas versus Nevada Yellow Cab, this court noted that employees are to be paid for every hour worked, regardless of industry. So while these purposes don't provide a specific definition of work, they certainly dictate a rejection of the suggestion made by Western Range and AMICI that there be a new rule developed specific to the conditions for sheep herders. The rule that this court adopts should be the same for all industries.
What do you do with the, it's troubling to me, you're asking us to ensconce in our minimum wage amendment a definition that if you look at section 213A6 of the federal statute, it specifically provides and has since 1966 that the minimum wage and maximum hour requirements on federal law under the FLSA do not apply if the employee is employed in agriculture and is principally engaged in the range production of livestock. So I kind of feel like we're being asked to create a unicorn when the Minimum Wage Act amendment, which was passed to put us $1 ahead of the federal minimum wage, was passed. The federal law had this exemption that still remains in Section 213 for range workers. So under federal law, that your argument wouldn't fly, but you want us to read this into our Constitution. So it would become immutable and something that would not have been available under federal law at the time the minimum wage amendment was passed. I know that's a convoluted question.
Your Honor, I understand exactly where you're going, but I think this court addressed exactly parallel circumstances. For example, in Jane Roe Dancer, federal law, the FLSA also has a tip credit provision, but Nevada law does not. And even though Nevada law regularly looks to the FLSA for guidance, where there is a substantive difference between Nevada law and the federal law, it will not incorporate such FLSA exemptions. So for the tip credit addressed in Jane Roe Dancer, similarly, the FLSA and Section 608, Chapter 608 of the Nevada statutes exempt cab drivers from minimum wage. But in Myers versus Reno Cab and Thomas versus Yellow Cab, this court held that just because there's an exemption under Chapter 608, that does not mean that it gets imported into the minimum wage amendment, that the minimum wage amendment by its terms applies to all employees other than certain individuals specifically carved out under the age of 18, et cetera. And for the same analysis that this court adopted in Thomas v. Yellow Cab about not incorporating such carve-outs, even though it otherwise
but may that's not the definition of work. That's the definition of who gets the minimum wage.
But what you were pointing to, Your Honor, in terms of the exemption for herders out on the range, that is also not the definition of work. The FLSA is not saying that those herders are not engaged in work. It's saying that there's an exemption, just like there's an exemption for cab drivers or a certain difference in how tipped workers can be paid.
But it also takes them outside the maximum hour requirements as well.
There is, yeah, and there's no overtime claim here. There's no maximum hours at issue here. This is purely a minimum wage claim. And although the minimum wage amendment itself does not contain a definition of work, in looking to parallel statutes, if you look not at Chapter 608, which does not itself contain a definition, but the Nevada Administrative Code, Section 608.115, defines hours worked for purposes of 608 as all time worked by the employee at the direction of the employer, including time worked by the employee that is outside the scheduled hours of work of the employee. And that's very consistent with the FLSA's definition of work that the Supreme Court adopted in Tennessee Coal, which is any activity controlled or required by the employer and pursued necessarily and primarily for the benefit of the employer and his business. Those definitions are similar, and that similarity confirms that this court should do as it has done in numerous cases before and look to the parallel FLSA for interpreting undefined terms in the minimum wage amendment. That was done in Doe Dancer. It was done in Gonzalez versus State. It was done for Chapter 608 in Terry versus Sapphire. One of the advantages of doing so is that the FLSA has a substantial body of cases addressing what is work in general, but in specifically with respect to on-call time or waiting time. The U.S. Supreme Court defined waiting time that is controlled or required by the employer and necessary and primarily for the employer's benefit to be work back in 1944 in two related cases of Armour and Skidmore. Both cases involved private firefighters protecting industrial plants where the firefighters were required for 3 to 4 nights a week to remain in a fire hall for a 24-hour period, equipped with sleeping facilities, cooking facilities, and you know, certain amusements for their benefits, such as radios, pool tables, dominoes, and so on. But in that case, because the reason they were staying in that fire hall, the reason they were to be available to the employer was for the employer's benefit, in Armour, the Supreme Court affirmed a lower court ruling that all of that time counted as hours worked other than time allowed for sleeping that was not interrupted. And in Skidmore, the court reversed a lower court finding holding that such time was not hours worked. And as the Supreme Court explained in Armour, readiness to serve may be hired quite as much as service itself. And time spent lying in wait for threats to the safety of the employer's property may be treated as a benefit to the employer and thus count as hours worked. And that's an apt description of what the sheep herders are required to do, is to wait for threats to the safety of the employer's property.
I have a little different question. In order to answer the question posed to us by the federal court, is it asking us to apply whatever the law is to this particular case and your particular client? Because that's usually not what we do in NRAP 5 cases.
I understand, Your Honor. And I think at a minimum, to answer the certified question, this court needs to articulate what the law is in Nevada, what test will apply to this type of issue of what work is, what counts as hours worked. I do think that because this court, in its certified question cases, accepts the facts as set forth in the certification order, certainly I don't think anybody's asking this court to make factual findings or to resolve disputes of fact. This came up even in the district court at summary judgment, so even there would not expect to see the court resolving disputes of fact. But if we look at the facts that the district court did incorporate in the certified question, it included that the plaintiff was not allowed to leave, that the plaintiff was always performing some job duties, and that only some of the time, such as when sleeping and eating, was the plaintiff spending some time for his personal benefit in addition to fulfilling his responsibilities as a herder to be aware of and take care of the sheep. Based on those facts, and the I will say there's, following Ardmore and Skidmore, a rich set of case law that has developed under the FLSA, looking at a wide variety of circumstances of on-call cases, and the Ninth Circuit sort of crystallized all of those into a multi-factor test in Owens and Berry, and that if the court were to adopt that as the governing law for the minimum wage amendment, those factors could easily be applied to the facts that the court and the district court included in its certification order to reach a conclusion as a matter of law. But I think that all that the court is required to do is to do the first step of deciding what the law is. And if it chose, could send this back to the district court for application of the law to the circumstances of this case.
And as we're deciding what the law is in terms of defining work, you know, it's kind of one of those, I think it was described as, you know, waiting, whether or not you are engaged to wait or waiting to be engaged, that's kind of the tension there. Do you promote the adoption of the Owens test, the Owens framework, rather, in deciding that issue?
I think that is the Owens and conjunction with Berry, the two most leading Ninth Circuit cases that really crystallize a formal test that has been used throughout the Ninth Circuit in interpreting this issue under the FLSA, and we think that makes the most sense rather than sort of starting from scratch and creating a new test.
Thank you.
If the court has no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Anthony Hall, and I have with me Ellen Winograd, representing Western Range Association. I'd like to begin by kind of pointing out that when I reread the brief submitted by the parties, I was struck by the fact that it seemed we kind of went a little bit far afield. We lost the forest for the trees, as I would say. That the appellant spent something like 30 pages arguing the facts, and in response, we spent over 15 pages doing the same thing. And as Justice Kadish's question just illuminated, that's really not the question before this court. And so what I'd like to do is focus in on the parts that I am admitting that I think we did an inadequate job of really developing in our briefing. And the first principle that I want to focus on is comparing the language of the minimum wage amendment to the NRS and comparing it to the FLSA, which is a critical question for this court to do, because there's plenty of case law where this court has said that the Constitution must be squared with and reconciled with our statutes. So that's the first and critical thing. How do we make these...
I would put it the reverse way.
Exact. But when the language is adopted that mirrors the existing state law, that is very helpful as a tool for guiding how it's to be interpreted. And since the language in the NRS existed since 1985, and they use the same language in the minimum wage amendment, I think that that's probably our best guide for determining what is the interpretation. And then we should compare that to the language of the FLSA. And when we do that, what we'll find is that there is a significant and material difference between the language of the minimum wage amendment and NRS, which are very similar, and the FLSA, which has material and significant differences. And that's where I'd like to start. First, the NRS and the NWA simply say work, and that's significant. They don't modify that term. They ask the court to apply the minimum wage when someone is working. The FLSA, on the other hand, says you are employed when you are suffer or permitted to work. In fact, the statute, the language, which is 29 U.S.C. section 206, where it says here's the obligation to pay the minimum wage, doesn't even use the term work. It uses the term employment. Employment is suffer or permit to work. So they use a very broad term, and that's important because we've known that language since 1944 when the Supreme Court addressed it. That language was rejected by the drafters of the NRS. By NRS, it was also rejected by the drafters of the minimum wage amendment. They did not say suffer permit to work. They said it's work. That difference is real and material. Importantly, I want to focus on that for another angle, which is, let's talk about the history of the Nevada statute. If we look at the 1973 and the 1977 versions, I'm not going to focus on before that because, in fact, those amendments talked about whether or not women get minimum wage, and I don't think that's really relevant to our discussion today. But as of those two amendments, the statute in the Nevada statute specifically recognized the FLSA. And so it said, hey, you get FLSA. If it doesn't apply, you get the Nevada minimum wage. In 1985, they rejected the reference to the FLSA. In 1985, the Nevada statute rejects it, also rejects suffer permits to work, and adopts just the word work. And that is a material difference that was known to the drafters of the minimum wage amendment when it was passed. As a result, that difference is a material difference that I want this court to talk about and to focus on. If we then look at the regulation of the NRS 608.010 defines an employee as a person in the service of an employer. So instead of using broad language, suffer permit to work, they reject it, and they use narrow language that you must be in the service. Our Nevada NRS, as well as the minimum wage amendment, are a fairly simple formula. You have to be an employee working for an employer. The employee must be in the service of the employee, not suffer permitting to work. That distinction, once again, means that we should look to NRS 608, not the federal statute, for what the minimum wage amendment means, especially because it used the same kind of language and rejected the same kind of language that the NRS rejected. I want to stay focused on the FLSA for just a moment, because there's another important distinction here that I think this court should be aware of and think about when it renders its decision.
Counsel, so, before you move on, just with the NRS 608, if we strictly look to that statute for guidance as to someone like the party in this case who, for all lack of a better term, is on call 24 hours a day, it really doesn't add or give us any guidance in terms of how we define work. So what are we to do with that?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question, and I'll come back to the point I was about to make, but that's a very good question, and we do have guidance on that. We have guidance because this court has said numerous times, and in particular the most recent in Paulable versus State in 2012, that the Constitution was written to be understood by voters. Its words and phrases were used in their normal and ordinary as distinguished from its technical. The FLSA gives us a very technical definition, suffer permit to work. We have hundreds of cases where that has been expanded and expanded and tests have been devised, and I'll go into how far afield it has come from work in a little bit. But that's a very technical definition. The way we are commanded to interpret the Constitution when it says work is the ordinary meaning. The ordinary meaning can be found by looking at Webster's Dictionary of 1984, the published version that was out when we adopted the NRS that used the exact same term. And that says physical or mental effort or activity directed toward the production or accomplishment of something. Something has been done, made, or performed. We also, Your Honor, can look to, again, ordinary meanings. I would look at the Oxford Dictionary for the opposite, the antonyms of work. And what are those? Play, leisure, rest.
What are you to do with, for instance, counsel's example where you have firefighters who are staying at the fire station because they're on call and they have to be ready to react to emergencies, but they're playing dominoes while they're waiting to be called? That is not really helpful in helping us analyze whether or not that's considered work. And so I appreciate the dictionary definition, but I don't think it elucidates, for me at least, drilling down on what it means to work within the context of someone who is constantly on call.
Your Honor, I would argue that it does, because we would then ask him specifically, are they working? Are they performing duties? If the answer is yes, they're working.
Wouldn't the Owens test be a good way to analyze whether or not they're working or not?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe so. The Owens test, unfortunately, goes far afield. We have courts applying the Owens test where they actually say, well, we're going to find that it's not work because they weren't free to take some other job. That test has gone far afield from asking the fundamental question.
Well, you just said if they're performing duties, then they're working.
Your Honor, that would be the primary question. And the question that this court has asked,
I thought you just said I would ask the person if they're performing duties, and if so, they're working.
That would be the fundamental test we'd be asking. Are they working? Are they performing the work they were engaged to do in the service of the employer? And if so, the ordinary...
You said about performing duties, and I ask because obviously we take the facts from the certified question, and the certified question proposed to us says that the gentleman was always performing job duties.
Your Honor, it says multiple things contrarily. The actual certified question ends up saying exactly the opposite, which is, and I will read that part of it, and that he was free to perform...
I believe it's counsel says Castillo was not allowed to leave and was always performing some job duties, even though some of the time he spent on the range for his personal benefit.
Yeah, it specifically indicated that he was doing things for his own benefit and his own efforts, and that's the question. This court is not being asked to determine the factual question. I will say that is very disputed. Our clients are going to present evidence and did present evidence that he was not, in fact, working, that he was told not to leave camp, and at night he was free of all duties. That's the factual question.
He was told not to leave camp?
Not to leave camp at night, absolutely, because to go after the sheep. Let me make that sentence complete. Not to go after the sheep. The owner is going to basically say, look, I don't want a guy carrying a gun going after a lion out in the middle of the night. That's what the guard dogs are for. So that's the factual question. That's not in front of this court. What is in front of this court is what's the definition of work without the modifier of suffer or permit in Nevada.
So, go ahead. How would you propose this court answer the question?
I would propose this court answer it by either adopting the standard definition that was understood at the time, Webster's, or the original Tennessee coal definition that the Supreme Court adopted in 1944 before it modified it in the Armour case. Because the Armour case modified it because of the suffer permit language. That original definition that they ran with, I think, is a valid common understanding definition that this court should adopt, not the expansion that has led us down a lot of myriad paths. And that's kind of important. If you look at the Armour decision, to be very specific, the very last sentence, the court says it's suffer permit to work. And then in the paragraph, it says, now, I know we just told you in the prior case that it means this, but we're now going to expand it. So the entire structure is because of suffer permit to work. I would ask this court to look at the history of how that language has been treated very broadly to lead us to where we're at today in the Owens Court. Instead of just work, it's suffer permit. The 29 CFR 785.10, which is the federal government gathering all of these cases together and saying, here's what we think all of this means. They are very telling in what they say. They say scope of this subpart. This subpart applies and the principles to the problems which frequently arise whether employees are suffer or permitted to work. And then it goes into 14 pages where it develops all of these other tests. It goes into the Owens test, although it doesn't specifically identify
Mr. Hall,
it.
Let me interrupt you and ask you this. If your interpretation of Nevada law is correct, and we were to adopt it, I'm looking at, we have several Nevada statutes that specifically allow employees in certain circumstances to agree, for example, to agree in writing to exclude from wages a regularly scheduled sleeping period, NRS 608.0195, I think. I'm trying to read my own writing. And I'm not saying that statute applies in this case, because it does not, but my question is that why would Nevada law have to allow a, in particular circumstances an exception for sleeping period if no one could ever get paid for a sleeping period?
Your Honor, I think I understand your question, and so if I don't answer it, please restate it. Those are particular circumstances that are providing carve-outs. So, for example...
But my question is, why would there need to be a carve-out to allow them to say, no, we don't have to pay you for a sleeping period if one could never get paid for a sleeping period because they're not actively working?
One potentially could, and they were defining it, if there was work being performed or that was work being performed, I guess is the bottom line. For example, in 608.0195, where we are dealing with residential facilities and 215 subsection 1, domestic service workers,
right?
The legislature here was creating a different paradigm than just the work question. And they were saying, okay, if they have at least 5 hours, it is not work. And when they are interrupted, only the period of interruption is considered work. And that's the important thing that I would take actually from those very specific subsections where they've addressed sleeping, is that they specifically pointed out that it's only when they're actually interrupted, when they're called to duty, is it now work time. When they are sleeping, it's not work time. That same concept is encapsulated in our NRS 608.019, where it calls out meal periods, right? So meal periods, they say it's a 30-minute meal period, but if it's interrupted, it doesn't count. The idea is if you're interrupted and actually called to duty, then now all of a sudden it's work. It wasn't work before. So the two underlying principles of those is that the sleep time wasn't work unless you're called to duty. The meal time wasn't work unless you're called to duty. That is consistent with the argument that I'm making. It's merely putting some parameters for some specific industries and some specific examples that are educational for us, but not dispositive.
I hope your suggested test is a little oversimplifying because there's something in between sleep and the traditional definition of work, right? Let's say somebody works at a grocery store stocking and there's nothing to do for a few minutes. How do we manage that? Does that person not get paid even though they have to be at the store and they have their shift that they're supposed to be there for?
Your Honor, I'll answer that in two ways if I can briefly go over time. The first is that I don't think it's overly simplistic. We're still asking the question, are they working? To use your example, just because they may not be actively doing something that they need, they're still engaged in the workplace. That clerk, as you mentioned, might be watching for customers, might be walking up and down the aisles to see if there's something that's been spilled. They're still working. They're still doing that, even though, a wildlife photographer, right? They might be waiting for that perfect bird to fly in on that flower to take the picture, but they're working that whole time. They're working. We ask, is that the duty they're engaged to? This court is not being asked to apply the facts. What we're asking for is a straightforward definition that is not the same as the FLSA because the FLSA language is not the same. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, my colleagues just argued that knowing what is in the FLSA and not including it explicitly in the NWA means it was a rejection of that language and a rejection of that concept. That's essentially asking this court to overturn Doe Dancer 1 because NWA also does not contain any reference to the economic realities test for deciding who is an employee. Obviously, that was also a known concept at the time the NWA was adopted, and it was not that language was not incorporated into the MWA, and by the logic that counsel for WRA has argued, Doe Dancer, Gonzalez, other cases, all of which said that the MWA or NRS 608 incorporate the FLSA, even where they don't have that language, would have to be thrown out and new concepts thrive to answer those questions based solely on the language of the MWA. And I think that invites a fair bit of chaos into What this court has done over the last many years to develop a line of authority of how to interpret the MWA. Counsel specifically said that voters couldn't have understood the technical definition of work that is part of the FLSA. Again, no more so than they would have understood the technical concepts of the economic realities test. Nonetheless, in Century Steel and in Doe Dancer, this court said that voters or the legislature, when it's looking at a statute.
But counsel, don't you think in all those instances that you just mentioned, the people being compensated are actually working, actually engaged in work? A ballot provision that suggested to Nevada voters you can be paid for sleeping, or you can be paid for playing guitar or reading, you know, I mean, in a different context, might not have been as successful. This is a unique thing. I mean, the home is on the range. No pun intended. Sorry, it writes itself. But they live there on the range. That's the job. There's a fixed monthly rate that's anticipated, that's known, right? I think it was $750 at this time.
Yeah, it's a fixed rate. I think $800, but yes.
They get bored. You know, room, depending, sometimes they move around, sometimes outside, like that's all known up front. So the question is really, is that a job where you're living that is compensable for 24 hours a day, 365 days a year? Is that what you're suggesting to this court is the proper test?
I've suggested what the proper test is looking at the fact, and we haven't really discussed the Owens factors, but I suggest the test is to actually dive into those factors and look at those. But I would say that it is often the case, as the court did, Supreme Court did in Armour, that sleep time may be excluded, but other hours still found to be work.
And I want to return to the, and it ties to Justice Stiglitz's point, that under federal law at the time the MWA was passed, sheep herders were outside the FLSA. So you're asking us to interpret our MWA to provide compensation for sleeping for people who would not be compensated under the FLSA for sleeping. So even if they had a more nuanced legal understanding of the FLSA, you still end up with this kind of unicorn of putting in a standard that even the FLSA doesn't endorse. So it's perplexing to me because we work hard to make the Constitution match what the voters adopted when they adopted the amendment, and I struggle. It's kind of a bridge too far.
You can briefly respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. So as I was saying, not specifically asking for a ruling on sleep time, acknowledging that many courts have carved sleep time off from the definition of work, but plaintiff is engaged in work in the and some of the examples given of somebody at a grocery store watching to make sure customers aren't shoplifting or aren't waiting to be assisted. Firefighters who, while waiting for that emergency call, are playing dominoes. Somebody who is responsible for the safety of the herd, and there's no dispute, I think, under the federal regulations, their responsibility is to the safety of the herd, to ensure that they're not straying, to ensure they're not eating poisonous plants, to ensure they're not being subjected to attacks by predators, that involves a lot of standing around and watching the sheep and not necessarily walking around or standing or sitting. All of that is still a work duty. The fact that you can listen to music while doing work, I mean, truck drivers listen to music while they're driving long haul, that doesn't mean it's not hours worked because they got some enjoyment from singing along to the radio. And I'm sorry, I think I've gone over my time, but I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Thank you. Thanks for the briefing and arguments on the-